welcome to another exciting episode of Bored Chitless. I'm Lecky, and this week I'm joined by...
Tristan.
And we've been playing Tyrants of the Underdark. Tyrants of the Underdark is a territory control game with a deck-building element. That's what the blurb on the box says, anyway. And I would probably say it's more of a deck-builder with a territory control element. But we could argue about semantics all day, couldn't we, really? It's basically each player's a drow house leading a noble family in the Underdark. Similar to the sort of guild in Lords of Waterdeep, you're all trying to get one over on each other and progress as quickly as possible in order to control as many territories as possible. So it's built up into like little villages and cities, and you've just got to get as many of your soldiers onto the board as possible. And the game ends when the marketplace for the deck builder element finishes or clears out, or it ends when one of the players has got all their soldiers out of their soldier pool. Is that about it, Tristan? Have I missed anything there?
No, that's pretty much it. It's a VP race, isn't it? So it's yes. All about collecting victory points, and you can either do that by, well, you do that by putting your troops onto cities in Underdark. So yes. This is a Dungeons & Dragons setting, Forgotten Realms. It's right on my alley. I read all the Drow books when I was a kid growing up. And so you get like all the sort of house names and stuff, like the House Bainra and stuff are all from the books. And it's basically it's a massive dungeon where the drow houses are, as you say, competing. It's like an inverted version of Waterdeep, isn't it? It's all underground version.
It's all very dark,
lots of dark elves. And so to get victory points, you build your deck like you would in any normal deck builder, so you're sort of honing your deck, and you get more points if you promote cards out of your deck into your victory point stash. So all cards have a higher victory point value if you can promote them, which basically removes them from the game, from your deck, but makes them worth more. So you've got to kind of combine promoting your rubbish starting cards out of your deck, which are worth 1 point if you promote them, or nothing at all if you don't promote them, and then getting really cool cards into your deck. And so kind of a nice dynamic there is when you get these new cool cards like dragons and powerful dark elf priests and wizards and stuff, they have these great effects whilst they're in your deck. They let you do more stuff, but they're worth even more points again if you can promote them. So you have this kind of choice of like keep them in deck for as long as I can, you know, get them to the table as often as possible. Or do I promote them out and get just a shed load more victory points for them? And whilst you've got that going on, you've also got the dynamic of having to put your troops down into the cities in the Underdark. And if you can control cities, you get victory points. Some cities offer a victory point bonus on your turn if you can control them. And so you can collect victory point tokens as well.
As you're going along,
VPs, and there's like different sort of approaches you can take. And the main meat of the game is putting your troops down onto the table using your deck. So you play a hand of five cards, standard sort of deck building mechanism, and then those cards will let you place troops or assassinate enemy troops, or put your spies down, and you can put spies in different people's territory. You basically, when you place troops, they have to be adjacent to your existing troops, but with spies you can break that rule and chuck them onto the far side of the map into somebody else's territory and start building outposts, you know, right in the middle of their base sort of thing. So the cards directly affect the territory control. And it's a really cool sort of combination of the two, I think. When you place troops down, they have to be adjacent to one another. But if you can break that mold by placing spies, you only have five spies, but you can place spies anywhere on the board. And once you put them down, placed presence there, which means you can start building outposts in the middle of enemy turf and stuff. And of course, if you do it to you at the same time, there's loads of intriguing back and forthing, assassinating each other's troops, and just lots of fun backstabbing and front stabbing.
There's a lot of player interaction, isn't there? And it reminds me a little bit of Carcassonne, those sorts of games where you've got to build your little soldier train from one town to the next in order to populate them. But then someone's always going to try and block you off, or they're going to throw a spy in to make sure you don't get total control, so you don't get that extra VP. And it can be a little bit frustrating. Yeah. So you're constantly trying to work out how can I remove their soldiers at a minimal cost? Because with the two resources available in the deck pool, there you've got the influence, which is denoted by spider webs, and then you've got actual power, which is denoted with shields, and that's how powerful your soldiers are. And it'll cost you 3 shields to send a enemy soldier home, in which case it goes into your trophy hall, and you get that victory, but then you have to populate it with another shield in to take it back over. So a neat way around that is to have cards which will allow you to supplant. So they'll let you take a soldier away in exchange for one of your own, which is the most efficient way of doing it. But if you don't have those supplant cards coming through your deck, then it can be really expensive to try and get people out of your way. So the spies, like you're saying, they just mix it up, and they're a real danger, because a lot of the supplant actions rely on a spy being there. You'll bring a spy home, but he'll replace a soldier. So there's some nice little mechanics where you can really like mess up people's game engine.
Yeah, so the basic cards in your deck only provide you with influence, one influence or one power each. Mm. But every new card that comes into your deck gives you one of these cool abilities, like you said, like being able to supplant or place spies or assassinate other troops and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And that's where all the fun sort of comboing comes in. So you've got to keep an eye on your own deck, but you've got to keep an eye on what other people are doing as well. So if they start bringing loads of spies in, you need to try and grab cards with spies, because otherwise you're going to fall behind in the spy game kind of side of things.
And there's not a lot
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, there's not a lot of spy interaction that we saw, was there? There was a lot of sending other people's soldiers home, but you couldn't really get rid of a spy unless you wanted to pay the 3 power to do it. Get 3 shields out and just send them back.
Spies you can never kill. You can just return them back to the base, but it's troops that you can sort of assassinate and keep in your own trophy hall.
Exactly.
So... Oh, and they're worth VP as well. So the more kills, the more points you get. So it's like another way of generating VP, which means at the end of the game, it's unless somebody's literally blitzed the whole board, it's still kind of difficult to tell. You know, everyone's still in the running right up until the end, really. And even if somebody has blitzed the whole board, somebody else might have spent the whole game refining their deck and promoting cards out, in which case they still have a good chance of being in the running. So... You know, the difference in points, you end up with loads of points at the end of the game, but the difference between a couple of players could be a matter of like 3 or 4 points in some cases, which makes it kind of exciting. It's you don't know where it's going.
There's a lot to keep an eye on, and if you fixate on one section of it, then you can easily fall behind, or you can just forget what other people are up to, and then you've not really got a clue what the state of the play board is, really. It led to a nice tight game when we played it. I think I came last by 1 victory point, but there wasn't too many victory points between, was it you and Dave that were up at the front there? It was about 3 between the winner and the second place?
Yeah, Dave beat me by 3 points, so it was real close. But if you looked at the board, it looked very much like, you know, in fact, it looked like Jackie had romped to victory because she placed down all of her, which ended the game, and she had the most territorial control over the board, which looks visually really impressive. But if it's not combined with a well-honed deck and lots of VPs earned from controlling the cities, then it still might not be enough to win, which in her case it wasn't. But whereas David sort of treaded all the different elements of placing loads of troops down, promoting enough cards in his deck, and having enough VPs from owning and controlling cities for long enough that he managed to sort of dominate there. And with a four-player game, it's a very different dynamic, because you go through the market deck very quickly, and there's a very solid chance that that will end the game. But also in the two-player game, which me and Sam played after you lot had gone, you find that the market deck almost never empties. You're going to end the game by putting all your troops down first.
I see.
So that's another interesting thing. Yeah, and you control less of the board in a two-player game. You sort of mark out sections. Well, there are pre-designated sections which you just won't use in a two-player game. Similarly, with 3 players, you use less of the board.
I see.
And then in 4 players, it's all in. And 4 players has that added sort of frisson of danger where you're fighting against 3 other people. You never know where the next attack's coming from, so you're fighting a war on 3 fronts from the outset, which is kind of cool. Whereas in 2 players, it's very much head-to-head, back and forth. You know, you hit me and I hit you back, sort of thing. It's very nice. It's got a lot more interaction, I think, than Lords of Waterdeep, because rather than just blocking each other's actions, you're directly interfering with their forces and assassinating each other.
Yeah, when we discussed Lords of Waterdeep a couple of episodes ago, and we were talking about some of the take that elements are a little bit wet. Like you can force a quest onto somebody, but by mid game they're generally quite easy to accomplish, or you can just kind of get in front of someone on a building, and invariably someone else has built something that allows you to do a similar thing anyway. So there always seems to be a very easy way around it, whereas with this game, it seems to be a lot more expensive when you actually go for somebody and take some of their soldiers away. You know it's going to take them some assets in order to get back from it. So it feels like it's a little bit more cunning, really. I really enjoyed it, and I felt
definitely.
I felt like the balance between the deck builder and the area control was quite nicely done. And also, there's so much variety in the decks. You play with two particular sort of factions, do you, or sort of decks to start with in the marketplace?
Yeah, you have two half decks that you shuffle together to make the market. And we played with the basic suggestion dragons, but we have also, you could swap either or both of those out for a bunch of other decks. So it comes with four different options, but we've got the expansion as well. So there's a total of six there, and you could bring in undead or elementals or humans. And we've not even scratched the surface in terms of finding out what they do. Our decks were very much based on spies and assassinating, and there were dragons which would come in and blitz and give you loads of power and influence. We had doppelgangers which would supplant other people's troops and all that kind of stuff. What any of the text is, so I'm really looking forward to tucking into them next time and finding out what sort of variety they offer. We're probably wrong in comparing it to Lords of Waterdeep. Lords of Waterdeep is like a worker placement game. This is completely different. It's area control and deck building. So even though it's like still D&D, I think that's probably where we've made the link. And the fact that you can actually, Skullport is one of the locations in this game, you know, and it's one of the expansion locations from Lords of Waterdeep. So it's set in the same world, but shares very little game mechanics. But it does feel like they've finessed these types of games. Lords of Waterdeep is a very efficient and clean worker placement game. This is, it takes the best parts of deck building and does them efficiently, maybe not massively imaginatively, but the way that it combines with the area control is more imaginative and interesting. And you've got the great sort of interactions between the decks that you're playing and what's physically happening on the board, and you know, your development of troops and spies and your empire as you go. Very sort of cleanly put together, I think.
Very, very so. And like you're saying, you're right in that respect. It is similar to Lords of Waterdeep in terms of like the simplicity of the game. It's like, you know, Lords of Waterdeep isn't a particularly heavy euro. It's very easy to learn, but there's a lot of meat in there, and it feels the same with the deck building, like the sort of mechanics with this game. It doesn't take a lot of
introduction.
Yeah, you're
up and running in 5 minutes. Anybody played a game before will pick up those mechanics super fast because you know exactly what you're doing if you played a deck builder before.
Exactly, and it seems like the Dungeons & Dragons games, they're quite adept for that, because maybe they're looking at it from the point of view where we've got quite a big RPG audience, but we want to introduce them to new games, so this is how we're going to do it. We don't want to make it too heavy a game, just in case they're not into that. And also, maybe it's just to try and attract some more people that might have heard of the Dungeons & Dragons brand, might not necessarily play board games. So it's an easy way of identifying with new subject matter. And they do an absolutely brilliant job of creating these sort, like, you know, very elegant, very sleek games. Not the heaviest, not too difficult, but still with a lot of playability in there. Is there any expansions? Are there any expansions available for Tyrants in the Underdark? Or is it the at the moment is it the base game?
It's a small box expansion, so it's about £8, and it's two extra half decks. So that's the one we've got in the box. We've not actually played it yet, but I think it comes with like undead and elementals, or you know, two of the factions basically. So definitely interested to see what those do, but we don't even need to get to those first. We can go through the extra decks from the base game first as well. And it doesn't feel either like if there weren't other half decks, it would still feel pretty complete as it is. I think it'll add a lot more variety with the new decks, but if we set up that we did last time another 4 or 5 times, I'd still be interested to see how it plays out each time, you know, and get to grips knowing, familiarizing yourself with the cards that are coming out and stuff. So in that respect, I think there's a lot of replay in the core game as it is. If I had to make a criticism, I think first of all the box is too big for what comes in it, and secondly the graphic design, is very basic. It looks like it's a kid's game kind of thing. The backs of the cards is purple cards that says Minion in like a sort of obvious font sort of thing. It's and the cards themselves are very unimaginable, different sort of. The artwork is brilliant. The actual art for the cards is in the most part is great, sort of D&D dark elf art. But in terms of the sort of graphic design layout, it's just a purple border with different numbers, and the numbers are literally either in a circle or a square. So it doesn't look visually as good as it could. The black and blue forces, so when you pick a team, you pick a color. The black and blue are quite hard to distinguish on the map
They
because the
are,
board's
if they
quite
get close to
black
each
and blue.
other, then
Yeah,
it's hard to see
and
who's who.
same with red and orange as well. Very, very curious choice of colors for like the different sides. And there's the white AI we've not mentioned. So there's like existing forces in the Underdark, which act as basically barriers for you to sort of smash through to get to each other and to also take control of the cities. So there's like existing troops already pre-spawned on the board, which is another nice element because it sort of gives you that sense of like, A, there's a bigger world out there, and B, it gives you like some sort of cut your teeth on before you start digging into each other as well.
Exactly, and it means you can't just rush for the high value cities straight away. You're gonna have to spend some resources knocking them down. There's also a
Yeah,
lot
to
of
work through.
there's a lot of nice starter cards as well. So like the free gold and so the two influence and three influence cards that allow you to quickly supplant those or assassinate the AI sort of soldiers. So you can get rid of them quite quickly if you want to invest in your deck early on in the game. So it's that nice little incentive just to experiment, try building a deck quickly rather than just keep hoping, like buying, the two influence starter cards to hopefully get moving quickly early on. Another great thing about the deck builder side is that there's the keywords for the different factions. So there's like Malevolent or Guile. So I was building up all the Guile cards because they seem quite spy related. So a lot of them were place a spy and then with a secondary action of bring a spy back for influence or bring a spy back to assassinate somebody or supplant somebody. And that was really good for a first time play. I was just like, these Guiles look interesting. I'm going to keep going for them. There's a few occasions where I couldn't get them or there weren't any in the market, so I was buying other things. But as a rule of thumb, it meant that my game engine was up and running very quickly. And I think wherever it fell
Couple of
down,
some satisfying combos then.
exactly, yeah, but where it fell down was I wasn't really promoting anybody until late in the game. So I missed out from that side of things. But it was just like, it was a bit of a, it just made the buying decision so much easier, especially with a deck builder when the first few turns, everyone's reading every card just to try and really understand what's going on with them. When what you actually want is for everyone to just quickly buy some stuff and just get into it.
Yeah, once we were up and running, the turns were flying
They
around,
were, yeah.
and you were like, "Oh, it's my turn," sort of thing. So very little downtime. There is no difference between the houses there. That's one thing Dave pointed out.
Yeah.
It would have been the easiest thing in the world. You've got seven influence and three power cards, so a 10-card deck to start off with. It would have been easy to swap out an influence card in each faction just to give some sense of personality to each of the
Yeah.
different houses, which it could be really easily fixed with a tiny promo pack of cards or whatever. But just to give one extra card that maybe has a different effect, like draw two cards, or it's two
Yeah.
influence instead of one influence, anything to just sort of vary and make it more asymmetrical. But I guess that's not necessarily a given thing. That's just it's our personal preference that we love variable player powers, and this doesn't really provide them until you get up and running, and then, as you say, you can build a Guile deck or a Malice
Yeah.
deck, or whichever option you want to go for.
Yeah, it's something you almost take for granted now, isn't it? Modern deck builders is the variable player powers and just like just something that gives your faction a bit more personality than others. And you see it in all sorts of games. It would be definitely nice to have. It doesn't ruin the game, but like you're saying, it could have easily put in there and easily just mess it up a little bit at the beginning, just
Mix it up.
yeah. And it gives you a nice clue of what maybe you should be aiming for to get going. For example, mine, like if I'm going for Guile, I could have had an extra like spy master card in there or something similar that lets me move spies around or swap them out. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, but a fantastic game, really. I enjoyed it. It was
really impressed with it.
I don't think it was the sort of game that Go I'd on. bust into my top 10 after more plays, then maybe I might, like, you know, learn to love it a bit more. But it seems like a nice game to get going with, and a great one to mix up the repertoire, really.
Agreed. Yeah, it's as you say, probably wouldn't make my top 10 either, but really solid fallback game, and I'm definitely excited to play it more and discover more. And it might, you know, it might go up in estimation as I get more plays out of it. But it has made me wonder why I held off for so long, because, you know, the theme of dark elves and D&D and stuff is right up my street, catnip sort of thing. And they do it so well. They did with Lords of Waterdeep. They've done it again here, and now it's making me want to get a sort.
Yeah.
The Giants, or whatever it's called, the other one in the series. It's another game again, but yeah, no, it's for a game that's a couple of years old now. I think it's really solid, really fun, and whips along. So with four players, we rattled through in a couple of hours. So it doesn't outstay its welcome either, and provides a lot of sort of meat and enjoyment. Yeah, no, it's a really solid game.
That's it. You made a really good point there. It's like dredging up a bit of a point we made earlier, I suppose, a little bit. But like you're saying, I think the D&D moniker on it, the Dungeons and Dragons moniker, might make it appear as though it's a novelty game. You know, it's just there for as a cash cow. But they are quite considered. You know, they've put a lot of effort into creating these games in the D&D universe. And if you're into that, and you've kind of been put off because you thought, oh, well, you know, they just after more of my money, it's not really like that. Just give it a go. I think you'll be really surprised with these sorts of games.
Yeah, they've got a baseline of high quality, and it's, you know, I'm really impressed with what they've done in the board game space so far. It's good.
Excellent. Well, that's it, really. That's our view on Tyrants of the Underdark, and we'll, I suppose we'll be back next week or the week after, maybe, depending on what people's living arrangements are, with more talk on games. So thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.